cons and against the commission up to a maximum of $10,000. And we believe that right vested at that point in time. We don't believe the legislature could come along in 79 and change that by either increasing it or abrogating it. I see the recovery fund as a tree. The trunk of the tree is the state. The fruit of this tree is payments to the victims to restore them, to make them whole, to pay them their actual damages. But the root of this tree is the accrual of the cause of action, the grounds of recovery that occurred in these two cases back in 1975. Everything emanates from that. And you have one action with procedural steps along the way. You don't have two separate causes of action. But however the court's reasoning in Lamb is analyzed, it calls for a retroactive application. Because the amendment became effective in 79 and the facts occurred in 75. That's a retroactive application to past transactions. And we don't believe the legislature intended any such result. We believe that the statute containing a $20,000 limitation is a substantive statute because it increases the rights or it increases the obligation of the commission. We believe that if it is not remedial, but if it's construed to be remedial, then we would cite the case of Brooks and the Garrett case cited in the Brooks case for declaring that even so, you do not apply the statute retroactively. The Garrett case had almost identical facts. Workman's comp, the maximum allowable per week for workman's comp was increased from $20 to $25 by amendment. And in the Garrett case, the court said, there being no express statement in the statute of retroactive application, we will not apply that $25 increased maximum to these facts which occurred prior to that, to the effective date of that maximum. Mr. Garner argues that Mr. and Mrs. Lamb are entitled to $20,000 or they're entitled to nothing. Well, first of all, we're talking about limits. So if the $10,000 is gone, then that would mean that for causes of action that accrued between 1975 and 1979, there is no limit. And you can be paid any amount out of the fund limited to actual damage. We certainly don't think the legislature intended a roof of $10,000 from 75 to 79, and then when they increased it in 1979, they took the roof off for the 75 to 79 period, but put a roof of 20,000 from 79 on. We just don't believe that was their intent at all. But he does argue that his clients are entitled to nothing if you don't apply this amended statute, this 20,000 maximum, to the facts in this case. We don't agree. We believe that Mr. and Mrs. Lamb had a vested right back in 1975 against the broker, Gaetan, and against the Real Estate Commission for payment out of its fund up to a limit of $10,000. While it would be attractive to apply this amendment retroactively because it would increase the amount of money they could be paid, what if the legislature had reduced that amount, as has already been pointed out, or abrogated it entirely by repealing the recovery fund section? We stand for the proposition that Mr. and Mrs. Lamb are still entitled to $10,000. And the legislature couldn't do that because that would be in violation of the Constitution as a retroactive law. And they certainly didn't intend that. We'd like to point out that if the $20,000 is applied retroactively, then we are certainly not encouraging or rewarding the diligent who prosecute their lawsuits to completion. Plaintiff's lawyers in the future, every time they get wind that the legislature is going to meet, will postpone their cause of action in hopes that the maximum may rise. We believe that the legislature could have done three things. And had they done these three things, Mr. Garner and Mr. Burmeister would be correct, the court in Lamb would be correct, and the court in Pace would have erred. And we wouldn't be here today. First, the legislature could have changed the language on or after the effective date of this act to on or after May 19, 1975, if it intended one effective date. It didn't change the language, and we believe it didn't change the language because the legislature intended two effective dates, 75 for the $10,000 maximum and 79 for the $20,000 maximum. We also believe that even if they had change the date to May 19, 1975, there would be a question of the constitutionality of that. But the legislature didn't do that. Second, the legislature could have stated that the $10,000 limit for the period of 75 and 79 was repealed expressly. But the legislature didn't do that either. The statute is not repealed. It still exists for those grounds of action that arose between 1975 and 79, which are the two fact situations in this case. There was no repeal. These two statutes can be harmonized and read together. There is no absolute contradiction. There is no repeal. And again, we doubt whether that would be constitutional. The third thing the legislature could have done would have been simply to say that this amendment is to be applied retroactively. It could have said it's to apply to all pending litigation. But we believe that there may have been a question of the constitutionality of that also, because it still would have been a retroactive application. The legislature didn't do that either. The legislature didn't do these three things. They didn't do any one of these three things. Are we to construe that despite their failure to take any of these three steps, that they intended their result or that result anyway? And if we do so conclude, are we not rewriting the statute? We certainly sympathize with the victims in these two cases. We want them to be paid the most that is legally permissible. Mr. and Mrs. Lamb have already been paid $10,000. Their actual damages were $12,000. Mr. Garner has not appealed treble damages. Treble damages, we think, are not payable out of the fund. And we believe that the statutory language supports our conclusion that treble damages should not be allowed. The fund should be limited to paying only actual damages, and that the $20,000 maximum should not be retroactively applied to the facts in these two cases. The court in Lamb strained at a result, a favorable result, I might add, because it would have gotten more money from Mr. and Mrs. Lamb. But the language of the statute simply doesn't support that conclusion. The court in Lamb strained and carried the language of the statute far beyond its capacity to accommodate. The statutory language restricts payment, and we respectfully request that the court in Pace be affirmed, denying treble damages and limiting Mr. Pace and Mr. Carr and Mr. Reed to a maximum of $10,000, and that the court in Lamb be reversed, limiting Mr. and Mrs. Lamb to the amount of $10,000 which they have already been paid. Thank you.
May I please support? Governors, there's one point that I wish to respond to that Mr. Warner made. That concerns when he was reading from Section 3B, he referred to the phrase on the grounds described in Part 1A. What that language is talking about is when an aggrieved person recovers a judgment against a broker on the grounds described in Part 1A, then we go to Part 1A, and it, the last two paragraphs of Part 1A on page 16 of the booklet talk about a violation of Section 15, paragraphs 3 and 4, or a conduct which constitutes fraud, misrepresentations, deceit, false pretenses, or trickery. Those are the grounds that are being referred to in paragraph 3B, and those would certainly support the misrepresentation under the Consumer Protection Act.
Your Honor,
on paragraph 3B on page 17 of the booklet, it talks about when an aggrieved person recovers a valid judgment in a court of competent jurisdiction against a real estate broker or salesman on the grounds described in Part 1A. It's my contention that on the grounds described in Part 1A are those grounds on page 16 of the booklet towards the very bottom of Part 1A, where it says the use of the fund as provided in Part 1 of this section is limited to an act that is either, and it's got those two paragraphs. a violation of section 15, 3 and 4, and those are contained on page 26 of your booklet. Paragraph 3 talks about a licensee when selling, trading, or renting real property engaged in misrepresentation or dishonest or fraudulent action. Or paragraph 4, the licensee has been guilty of, and then it's got some 30 paragraphs that he could have possibly violated. It's my contention that those, that's what it means on the grounds, rather than the phrase reimbursing agreed persons that Mr. Warner alluded to. Unless there are any further questions, that will conclude my presentation. Thank you.
May it please the court. Justice Wallace, in response to some of your questions earlier, you were asking about the substantive law being repealed by the legislature. I don't believe a state of right can be affected by the legislature. I believe it's only if it's a remedial statute. I'd point out the case of Richarddale. Richarddale case is Aetna versus Richarddale. Richarddale case is a, one of minors, the parents' very vicarious liability for minors. And it was originally controlled by R5923-1. And in that statute, it said that parents were responsible for minors over 10. When the Family Code came in, that language was changed. It still left vicarious liability there, but it said minors at least 12. So what happens is that the 11-year-old in the middle got left out. It also increased the amount from $300 to $5,000. In the Richarddale case, an 11-year-old burned down a house while 5923-1 was in effect. A few months later, it was repealed, and 3301 came in. The court said that 3301 was binding for the case, and there was no cause of action against the 11-year-old. So I think that's a pretty much case in point, and we covered it quite extensively in our brief, and I think that's in point. It's important, again, Your Honor, that the court term that a remedial statute, so it doesn't affect a substantive right. To recap what I said earlier, I think I got a little confused. We have three theories. Either one of the three theories will support our position. Remedial statute, the amendment did away with the $10,000 maximum, and that our cause of action did not accrue, our right to apply didn't accrue until March 23rd, 1981. Any one of those three will support our position. The attorney for the Texas Real Estate Commission used the phrase and quoted from the statute, quote, on or after the effective date of this act, close quote, and seemed to put a lot of weight on that, that wording. That wording was in the original act of 1975. Those words written in 1975 must necessarily apply to the act of 1975. It seems incongruous to say that these words written in 1975 could apply to words that haven't been written, that may never be written. So we believe that the phrase, on or after the effective date of this act, the effective date of this act must be necessarily May the 19th, 1975. The other thing that the attorney for the Texas Real Estate Commission has touched upon is he said that the Lambs had a right against the commission in 1975. I wish we'd have known that in 1975 because we could have forgotten about Joe Gaffney and gone straight to the commission. Until we received a judgment that conformed with the statute, until we were unable to recover against a real estate agent, until we abstracted our judgment, until we proved up that our plaintiffs were not the spouse of the wrongdoing licensee and complied with all the statutory requirements, we had no right to recover from the recovery fund. And until March 23rd, 1981, the date we got our judgment, we had no right to apply. We had no right to seek relief. If we had done it before that date, you can bet the commission would tell us to go home and wait until we got our judgment, boys.
When would you say the limitation could run on this cause of action?
Our cause of action against the cause of action against the recovery fund would be a 2-year statute of limitations, as I understand it.
I understand. When would it begin to run? From the date of the judgment or from the date of this act?
I'd say the date of the final judgment to file our pleadings against the commission, file our application.
You see, there's an initial thing that we have to get over. To get a recovery, we have to do several things. We have to file against life is even in 2 years. Okay? We have to get a judgment that sets out. We could have got a judgment that didn't comply with the statute and we wouldn't recover. We could have lost the case and we wouldn't recover. Until we got to that point, there were several precedents there before we had the right to seek relief. If we had waited 3 years to file against Guy 10, then we wouldn't be able to recover from the Texas Real Estate Recovery Fund. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I don't see in the statute any limitation on time. It just says may, after final judgment has been entered, execution return nulla bona, and a judgment lien perfected, file a verified claim in the court. I can't read into that any time, any prescription on time. From
the general statute limitations set out in the statute is a 2 year general statute limitations, is that correct? That binds all litigation where there's not specific statute limitations set forth? Like Article 55, 30 something, it seems like. We have a general statute limitations statute in the state of Texas, and it's either 2 years or 4 years. I believe it's 2 years unless the statute limitations set out in the statute.
What I had reference to in my question is it says that no action for judgment shall be started later than 2 years from the accrual of the cause of action.
Yes, sir.
You were arguing that your cause of action didn't accrue until you obtained this judgment and had it returned nulla bona.
We don't get a judgment from the court to recover against the Real Estate Commission. We get an order from the court. The judgment necessarily
can obviously talk about your cause of action as the
as against life and Zeke.
As a fraud by the real estate agent.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, the last thing, very quickly, I'd like to mention is he alluded to the fact that we might have postponed our case so that we could get under higher limits. I think this is faulty thinking. The limits could have gone down. They could have been eliminated. Anything could have happened. I will say in this case that Cleo Lamb, 78, Bertie Lamb, 71, they paid $12,000 basically in cash to Guy 10 in a title company and were told, you get your deed in the mail in a few weeks. When they contacted Jack Anderson of Anderson J. in Pasadena, they found out that Joe Kaitian was gone, and there was no title, and the title company said, we can't close, the title's not clear. And, Your Honors, I would have postponed this case for another 10 years if I could have, because as soon as we took our judgment, as soon as we finished our case, that meant the Lambs had to leave their home. The owner of the home was in Huntsville, the Texas Department of Corrections, and he got out in December of that year. And he had let us know that he wanted the home back. And so if I could have postponed it 10 more years, I would have, because we don't really want the money. We wanted a home for our clients to live in. That's what their life savings were for. There's two other quick things I want to point out. If you'll notice in our judgment, in our order, there are no attorney's fees. The reason for that is that we did all this in the district court through agreement with the Real Estate Commission. We had no hearing or anything. Our discussions were that either the 10 is going to apply or the 20 is going to apply. If the court says 20, then the commission is going to appeal it. If the court says 10, then we're going to appeal it. So we just took our judgment for 10 and appealed it. There was no question as to punitive damages or exemplary damages or anything in our discussions prior to that time. I had a $36,000 judgment. There was no need to prove attorney's fees. So rather than have a hearing in Houston, when I'm in Dallas and the commission's in Austin, we just agreed to the order for $10,000 to appeal the maximum limit, the ceiling. And I think it's in our brief and it's in the state's brief also that was our agreement, to appeal the maximum ceiling. So I'd ask this court that in the interest of justice, if it decides that the maximum ceiling is $20,000, remand it to the district court for a determination of attorney's fees. Purely in the interest of justice, and I realize at the time I probably should have done it. It was through our understanding and our discussions prior to the time we came in here, prior to the time we took our judgment in the district court. And the last thing is that the statute says that the attorney general can protect only from spurious and unjust claims. Clem and Bertie Lamb, without a doubt, have a just claim. And I don't think anybody here would call it a spurious claim. And I'm not sure what right the Texas Real Estate Commission has to defend this suit. This is obviously a very good, close question, because we're here in this court today. The court Court of Civil Appeals has agreed with us. The Court of Beaumont has disagreed with us. What's happened is that there is a good question here. It's not a spurious claim. It's not unjust. With all that I've said, considered, we request the court to rule that the maximum ceiling in this case is the $20,000 ceiling, and that in the interest of justice, this case be remanded from district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Court will stay in recess for 10 minutes.
The audience, please rise.